Okay.
All right. I'm going to call the Lessard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council meeting to order. Thank you all for attending today. Should be an interesting field trip, but it was interesting to hear sort of the overview of the estuary project. Jim and I were talking. It sure seems like more than either of us completely understood was here. So I think it's helpful to see things like that. We do have in front of us an agenda. I would love to get approval of the agenda.
Motion to approve agenda.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. You were sent in advance of this meeting minutes of our last meeting in January. I would love a motion to approve the minutes.
So moved.
Any discussion, questions, corrections, thoughts? All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Just a question. Anybody have any conflicts that they would like to report today?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have any conflicts on this agenda, but I do want to report a thing that has recently come up. The city of Anoka approached my employer, Federal Premium Ammunition, and they are planning on naming the Kings Island Wildlife Area that they own, the city property, after Federal Premium Ammunition. I bring it up because they received a Conservation Partners Legacy Grant last year for doing habitat restoration work there, and since that money came through the Lessard Council, obviously I had nothing to do with that process, but it came from us. I just wanted to disclose that that is going on.
Okay. Anyone have any questions about that?
Thank you. For the record, this is the grant process run by DNR?
Correct. Yeah. They received their grant from the DNR through the Conservation Partners Legacy Grant.
Thank you.
Thank you for reporting that. Any other conflicts or things people want to report on? If not, Bill, if you can give us an executive director's report.
Yes, thank you, David. I want to encourage people, members and guests, to go to the website and experiment with our application system. We've spent quite a bit of time and money this spring putting it together. It's a very smart system. It tracks what you're requesting and asks questions based on questions, the way you answer questions. And I think you might find it interesting. We hope that the public finds it easier to use. We've had a test beta group that we've been working with, past applicants, and they've been very positive and favorable about it. Hopefully, people don't wait until the 29th of June to
discover how user-friendly it is.
Yeah. So I wanted to bring that to your attention. And then in your packet you have the council's legislative report, which is bound with a black binder. And I'm not going to go through this in great detail, but just list the bills that are in the report. And there's a summary of the information relative to the council in the Section 1. In Section 2 is copies of all the bills with yellow highlights on the reference sections in the bills themselves, with the exception of the bonding bill. We didn't include the bonding bill. It's large and not much of it was applicable. And those bills that we did review are the school trust land management bill, the legacy bill, the Omnibus Environment and Natural Resources Policy Bill, the Omnibus Game and Fish Bill, and the Bonding Bill, which is, in fact, summarized in a table on page 6 of the summary. So rather than go through this in detail, I think what we'd prefer to do is just stand for questions people had about the session or what's in these bills. I encourage you all to read this, especially the school trust land management bill and the environment and natural resources policy bill.
The school trust lands bill is going to be an interesting thing because there's little doubt in my mind that as a result of that, we're going to see DNR asking us to fund acquisitions from the trust fund, from the school trust lands, to protect lands that this would strip the protections from. My understanding is they were already preparing an application for this for the LCCMR, and we're going to submit that. I don't know, Kenny, you might have. Have you seen that? What?
They did submit.
They did submit for $5 million, is what Tom told me.
But it didn't make the cut yet.
So it may be coming through our new application system.
There's nothing we can do about it at this point, but it is an issue.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess what I'd say about that is that I guess the legislation maybe provokes some interest. The hard work is to come in the future. It will undoubtedly include us, but it will include mostly, as you know, trying to get extricate the school trust fund lands from protected lands, whether they be in WMAs or scientific natural areas or whatever, similar to what we've done already in state parks. And it does make some sense, but it's a long process. It's nothing you can do as quickly as passing a bill or anything else. It's just a lot of hard work. I think it'll be interesting, and I think it's probably a good process.
Hi, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think it is worth noting that on page 2 and the second paragraph, there's a little piece of legislation that withdraws school trust land on Lakeshore from the requirement that the legislature approve sales. And that may affect us more than anything in this bill and may put forth the need to protect Lakeshore that we formerly considered to be protected. So
I will say I met with the governor over that very provision and was told flat out that they liked the idea of not having to go to the legislature to ask for permission.
No doubt. I'd also like to thank Janelle and Greg and Sandy and Heather, who worked very hard on this with me, and appreciate their help.
Well, Mr. Chair, just to echo some of what Senator Saxon said, I think that the bill was a very good bill and a good thing for us to do in the legislature. It was very much needed, unfortunately, and mostly at the fault of previous legislation done. We weren't following the Constitution. The Constitution's pretty clear that these lands are supposed to be managed for the economic benefit of the kids. They still have to follow all the laws of our state of Minnesota for the protection and environmental and such. But we have some cases where costs were being incurred and economic benefit was not happening because we were managing this land for other than for the kids. And so it was really, I think, a good thing to move. And as Senator Saxhog has said, we have a lot of hard work before us now to deal with it. And some of this land we may want to protect just for environmental purposes, and then we probably need to figure out how we're going to compensate the kids and how we do that. If I'm not mistaken, we have a number of public boat landings on school trust land. Granted, they're just a few acres, but they're certainly not the economic benefit of the kids to have a public boat landing and concrete and gravel parking lot. There's no economic benefit for the kids, so that's clearly not constitutional to do that. And so, but the incidental, the one thing I will say that I think this group needs to be protective of the incidental use of the land for hunting and berry picking and accessing to a trout stream, we have to be very careful. Arguably, that has no cost involved in being able to do that, and we should not have to pay for that. Now, if you have to put up signs or something to clarify where the land is, or build a parking lot so that they can get to go hunt or fish or whatever they're doing, but incidental use of the land does not have a cost, and arguably I think we certainly want to be careful that we don't all of a sudden start to have to compensate for that unfairly.
One other thing I always have to bring up historically is, I guess it's been 5 years going on. About this time, a joint Senate House education group legislators went up north to tour the school trust lands and you know, outside the boundary waters. And one in particular, Senator Ann Lynch from Rochester, you know, she kind of was thinking this thing over. She said, "Now, so you mean that any money made off these school trust lands goes into the school trust and then it's supplanted and an equal amount of money goes into the general fund?" And everybody said, "Yeah." Well, you know, what reason would you have to make any money for the kids of Minnesota out of the school trust land if everything you put in there is supplanted? And it was when that piece of legislation passed, it said, you know, money in there is not supplanted, it supplements, that things started to cook. And that's where we are, kind of.
Jane, did you
have...
Any other questions on...
Just a comment on Bill's report on the application process. I had an opportunity to go through and look at that when you put up the invitation to review it. And I don't know who was all instrumental in putting that application process together, but it definitely works well. Heck of a lot better than it did before. And I think everybody should be very happy with what we're using now. Public should have no problem finding a way to work their way through that. So congratulations to who put it together. You did a good job.
Thank you. This is under contract with Houston Engineering.
And managed by our staff, because you don't just turn that project over to Houston Engineering and have it happen.
Yeah.
Other...
On page 25, under the Bowser appropriation, the wording to facilitating installation of conservation practices on drainage systems will result in water quality improvements, evaluate the outcomes of the installations. That's probably the largest oxymoron I see in the bill as far as drainage systems creating water quality. And the item E, the buffering area, I talked briefly with Greg on that. I think these two areas are going to come under extreme scrutiny in the next several years. And as far as the buffering on public waters, which is a totally ignored rule in agricultural production now, and it's starting to get some press and some coverage by the environmental groups and the cities, towns. So it's something I think we need to be aware of. Are we going to be allocating funds for something that should have been covered under normal conservation practices? It's going to be a very confusing area for a while. This is one thing I'd like to see the legislature put some teeth into this thing. Shoreline management rules, if you violate shoreline management rules by putting your house too close, doing things, opening up your drain field and polluting, you're going to get fined, you're going to get slapped hard with the severe penalties of it. But in agriculture production, we do it 100,000 times every day, and it just goes on unnoticed continually and continually. So just comments.
Other comments, questions, perspectives? I want to just acknowledge that as our bill went through the the process, it was incredibly frustrating to have the open meeting law as it applies to our commission in the way of having open communication between me and the rest of the members to try to get opinions and perspectives. There were a number of times where I was asked, what do you think? And I couldn't ask, what do we think? It had to be, Jim and I had a lot of conversations back and forth, but in the end, the process itself, the open meeting law that we have to operate under keeps us from having open communication on these issues, and it's a real burden to try to do that. So if you have problems with where we ended up on anything, and you think that somehow I had something to do with saying this is okay or I wish this, I'm here to tell you I wanted to talk to everybody, and there was no way at the last minute to send out an email and do that. It's just not allowed. So I'm as frustrated, I think, as you might be with that inability to communicate as things are happening fast. And I'd love to have sort of a conversation at some point about whether or not the open meeting law, as it's applied to us, which is different than the LCCMR, we can revisit at some point, because it's very hard to be chair and not be able to sort of poll the members for even opinions on things.
It tells me that the state does not really want me to do as good a job as I could do. It tells me that they don't really want me to be working as hard as I could be working and with as much information as I could get. I mean, beyond all the other things that we've said earlier about it being borderline insulting to anybody's integrity, it's a terrible hamstring to prevent us from doing as much good work as we could. And sharing information is crucial.
David, the chances of changing it are probably slim to none. And is there a way that we could work within the constraints of the law in the sense that maybe we accumulate our problem areas, start out with the executive council reviewing those, and let each individual member go to particular council members to get their opinions? That way we don't violate the quorum. I don't know.
Well, chain communication is covered by the quorum. It's the unfortunate thing. So we can't collectively have three members of the executive committee or seven members of the council talking about the same issue and communicating back and forth about that issue, whether it's a chain in email or phone conversations.
Are we reading something into 13E that isn't really there? I've looked through it several times, and I don't know that restriction is that tight.
Well, Janelle and Greg, do you guys, you understand it better than we do?
Sure, less. You also have to look at your own statute. I mean, you don't have to go very far into 13D. Just look at your own statute that says that if information is conveyed, it's a meeting.
Mr. Chair,
that means if any information, it means an email, that means that if five, six or seven of you or whatever are sitting in a bar, that's a meeting.
What about two of us, three of us?
No, okay. It has to be the quorum, and then information has to be conveyed.
Mr. Chair, the determination that chain communication is a violation of the quorum, I believe, is a result of case law. And the courts determining that that's the equivalent of holding a meeting if a quorum's involved.
So, Mr. Chair, how do we go about getting something changed in so that it will allow us to discuss topics such as when something comes through the legislative system and our bill has to change, that we then have an opportunity to get in to discuss that part of it? Because as soon as something changes, we should have the opportunity to revisit it. So what do we do?
Well, you know, the simple answer is if we were under the same rules as the legislature is under, as long as you don't make a decision, you're okay.
Sorry.
But we're not. We're under the municipal or the, and they'll help me, the local government rules which prohibit that. And so legislatively, we're going to have, if we're going to avoid this problem, there has to be some sort of change legislatively to the rules under which we're operating. And that's just the way it is.
Well, Mr. Chair, you know, we did try and change it, and it took the bill down.
I recognize.
It was in the 2011 bill, actually, and it was a Senate provision that we originally tried to accept. We did accept in conference committee, and when we came back to the House floor, that issue took the bill down because it was not acceptable. But I thought that isn't there ways that we individually can communicate to Bill a concern, and then can't Bill individually email us by blind copy that, you know, a member had a comment or something, and can't you act as a facilitator for the information? I mean, it's one thing that we're not individually stopped from commenting or individually talking to any one member. The most you have to be worried, if I'm not mistaken, is if you're a member of the executive committee, you can't communicate with two other executive committee members at the same time. That would be a quorum. But individually, we can talk to any one of us, and it's completely okay. And if I had a concern, I believe, can I, Bill, say, you know, send you an email, and can't you blind copy everybody to say Denny mentioned this or something?
Mr. Chair, representing McNamara, I'm not positive about this, but I've been acting under the assumption that the finding of the court in the gang task force situation where the executive director was found in violation of the open meeting law when he polled members of the gang task force on a PR public relations position. I've been acting under the assumption that the executive director was not a member of the gang task force as well, and thus was in a similar situation that I'm in. I've generally provided you all with information that's in the public domain, but rarely, if ever, provided you information that's private communication.
So, Mr. Chair, just a follow-up then. If I was to, I can't send you an email about here's what I see as a problem with what somebody's trying to do in the legislature, a change from what we as a council recommended, then you can't. But wouldn't that be in the public domain if you were to say, McNamara wants to change the invasive carp thing, members, here's what's going on, just so you know. Wouldn't you be able to do that if a legislative committee or the floor has taken action?
We will check with Deb Dyson on this. I don't think I can right now.
But even if he could, the important part that doesn't happen after that is us talking to ourselves in some way that gives your chair some directional guidance as to how to have communications about that issue. It's, you know, I guess that, you know, Denny, I know there was support from certainly a number of folks in the 2010 attempt to change this. You know, it might be something we should revisit and look at where the points of pain were, and can we specifically go and address those points of pain and explain how difficult it is in an attempt to find some different way to handle this issue, because it's very difficult to be sitting in this position and feel like you can't reach out and get input.
I think we have to look at the basic intent of 13D, and then I think we have to balance that with the Constitution. And if you look at the First Amendment of the Constitution, the right to free speech and the right to assembly under the fourth item of the peaceable to assemble. And by golly, when the state tries to make a law that's going to overrun the rights of the Constitution, that's when I think we have to back off.
But the constitutional argument there, Les, is that those are protecting the individual rights of people. In this function, we're not individual people, we're a government entity.
I still retain the right of individuality, too.
But when you work with us in collaboration, it's no longer individual, it's a government institution. And so restricting our ability to communicate in the function of Lasard Council, portion of the legislative branch of government in the state, that you certainly can restrict that. I mean, that's what the Constitution is there for, is
well,
to restrict government.
And you know, the gang task force was, you know, slapped for doing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we may not like it, but until someone creates a different outcome, you know, we've got a pretty clear path to how to stay out of trouble, and that's not do what they did.
David, Representative McNamara, I wonder if I could ask you, what are some of the issues that they have to hold us to a higher standard? I just don't understand why they would hold a group like us to a higher standard than the LCCMR. I mean, they basically do the same thing.
Mr. Chair, could we explain again how the LCCMR is different in line with Jim's question?
I think the big difference, as I understand it, they operate under the legislative rules, not the local government rules.
Okay.
They also don't have a majority of citizen members versus legislators. It's a balanced deal. So there's 6 and 6 versus 4 and 8. And so there's some sense we're different because of that. I would argue there's very little difference, but that was an argument I heard as to why we should be treated differently.
Thank you. Excuse me, Jim.
Well, I actually, Jim, I supported changing it. You know, I mean, I went to conference committee and brought it back to a house that really did not want to take it. I'm not sure, Mr. Chair, you laid it out very well what the issue is. The legislature has a hard time with a citizen body being able to skirt the open meeting laws the way they would be. There are some options available to us. I mean, we could anticipate that the legislature is going to review our bill and be proactive in scheduling meetings. I mean, you can cancel them. I think we decided as a body not to do that. We had an opportunity to schedule meetings so we could be aware, and I think clearly this body knew that it was going to get discussed and there was going to be potential for change to be considered, but this body made a decision to not want to have another meeting and look at that. So I think we have to be a little careful that all of a sudden we're saying, well, we weren't really getting a chance to weigh in. Well, I think we made a conscious decision to say, we've made our recommendation, you guys will do what you want to do, and we're going to move on. And that, you know, then to want to have, but we still should give input. I mean, if nothing else, individually give input. But there's the executive committee can meet on a pretty short notice under current situation by declaring some special situations. So that helps some. And I think even, Bill, isn't there ways that the full council can meet with relatively short notice? And when I say that, that's still days.
Chair, there's provisions for an emergency meeting, which generally the use of this is confined to natural disasters and things of that sort, but I think we could open it up to our form of natural disaster.
Even during session?
Yeah.
The challenge with scheduling meetings is, you know, as you well know, you don't know when you're going to actually get a bill passed and end up in conference committee, and that ends up being the sort of crucial time, at least it was this year, of what do you think? There was also a discussion that I was asked to engage in with the governor's office over one of the funding requests that they were thinking of vetoing, doing a line item veto, and I had to make the call.
It's lonely at the top.
Well, and it's not that I'm afraid to make the call. It's that everybody deserves to be part of it, and it feels uncomfortable for me to do that and not include everyone. And I just want to acknowledge that's going on and ask your forgiveness when I cross that, geez, you're not included, what did you do kind of thing, because it is a handcuff at this point.
Mr. Chairman, I will not be moving to recall you as chair.
You can do that. I'm not going to spend the money they spent in Wisconsin to retain the position.
Is there any problem with the executive committee meeting, executive members meeting, to discuss the same so you don't have to make those decisions on your own?
It becomes one of timing.
I mean, even by phone.
Yeah. We have problems with phone meetings. I think we can do it, but it's a little more problematic.
Mr. Chair, the executive committee is under the open meeting law, too. There is a provision for telephone meetings. There's got to be public access to the telephone meeting as well. You have to have the chair in the room with the phone where the public can come listen along with the chair, I believe, is the way it reads, is something like that.
And you do have to notice that, you know, we're not going to fix this right now. We're going to do the best we can. I just want everyone to know it is an ongoing issue, and it did rear its head a couple of times during this session, and I'm happy to give you the lowdown on any of it. I just want you to know I didn't try to withhold things.
Mr. Chair, sometimes in the sake of better information, better communication, and doing a better job, sometimes we might have to take a little chance in communicating some of these facts and risk getting slapped on the wrist for it.
Well, that's a decision each of us individually can make. I don't think we as a group can make it on behalf of everybody.
Mr. Chair, just said there are penalties.
Yeah.
Jail?
Well, there are two levels of penalties. One is the penalty in terms of the fines. The second is the reputational problem that this council does not want. And I would rather err on the side of being too careful than not careful enough, because I do not want to wake up knowing that I was pushing the limits and read that we were in violation of the open meeting law and giving everybody the reason to dump on us for other unintended consequences. That's my way I'm going to operate.
But, Mr. Chair, I do think that it should be clear we're not free to email to everybody here. That would, I think, pretty blatantly be a violation.
Absolutely.
But sending an individual email to any one person, and I would argue from my own standpoint, if I sent the same email to each one of the members here, but it was an individual email between myself and the member, I don't think I'm in violation when I send an email to each one. So that was my point about the blind copy. The blind copy is not, I mean, if you're sending, nobody knows who else got it, it's an individual email, they can't contact back to the whole group, but we can individually communicate.
My read is if you send the same email to a quorum, you're in violation.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Now, you as a legislator are in a different position.
Doesn't he have to meet both tests?
Mr. Chair, I think that's what Deb Dyson said when we had her in right after you were appointed. We'll have her in again to discuss these things. She is the legislature's expert on the law. But I do believe that I differ with her opinion, and to the extent that you may be, it depends on what hat you're wearing when you act. Are you wearing the Lessard Sams hat, or are you wearing the hat as chair of Environment and Natural Resources Policy in the House? Deb wouldn't agree that that's the case. I think a case can be made that you have a capacity as the chair if you're making a decision relative to the House committee. At least I'd have to go to court with that one.
Isn't it fun?
Better to be rid of.
So I just wanted everyone to know there were times I wish I could have reached out, but I wasn't allowed to, as I have interpreted what the rules are that we're operating under. So any other questions for Bill on executive director or council activities or the legislative session? Great. Well, I would thank staff for putting together this really complete analysis of what went on in the session. I found it very, very helpful to understand the landscape that we're operating in. And I certainly know it didn't happen overnight, so I appreciate the effort.
And the weekly emails that gave us updates, I thought were really key for me. That's where I got information, and they came out timely, and I really appreciated that.
That would be the Friday report.
Yep.
With that, we want to have a little discussion about our travel policy. Bill and I have talked about this, and we've done some work in the past about travel policy. It has not covered necessarily all of the circumstances, and Bill and staff put together sort of a summary of where we're at and some of the options, and I'd like him to spend a little time talking about that and then open it up for comments and questions.
The agenda item we're talking about is agenda item number 6. There's a little packet in your packet that has a background memo, an agenda item memo with background and suggested motion and procedures. I think the easiest thing to do is to say that currently the procedures that we adopted require a member who wants to travel for council business, which could be attending a meeting or viewing a site or something like that, talking with the public, has to beforehand ask the chair and the legislative member for approval of that travel, fill out, and they do that by filling out a travel request form. And it needs to be done in advance, and then you can travel, and the only requirement is that you report back to the council in writing as to what you were doing. That's for individual travel. The travel such as we have today is approved when it's approved as a council agenda item. So we've prepared and attached to the agenda item memo a white paper that basically summarizes the current travel situation, what the issue is, suggests some guidelines for travel, and then presents a number of member travel alternatives, individual elected travel, individual or small group travel with staff direction, and travel by the council as a whole. And then on page 6 is the current policy that we've adopted about travel. And page 7 is the travel request form.
So the question is for everybody, what are your thoughts on our current policy and do you want to modify it in some way? The one thing I know for sure is that the legislative, somebody has to approve it on the legislative, who is it, Bill? I'm lost. My words aren't coming very
well. A member of the legislature has to approve the expenditure of legislative funds, budget funds for travel. And after the fact, all expenditures of the council on an invoice basis are reviewed by the LCC as a body, I believe. For sure, the chair of the LCC reviews them all. So the one thing that we need to have in place is prior approval by the legislative member of the council. The executive committee of the council, which currently is Senator Ingebretson.
So, anyone have thoughts or comments? Or?
I have one question.
Sure.
On page 3, right above the member travel alternatives, there's a paragraph there that describes during the term of Chair Kilgore, the council agreed to not accept invitations to visit prospective projects. Now, I wasn't one of the original members. I missed the first year, but I don't remember that ever coming up before, one. And two, the Star Tribune, Dennis Anderson, took a side swipe at me in the paper this year because I didn't travel to one of the projects that was controversial and toured ahead of time. Sounds like I was within the policy guidelines of the council. I'm wondering if members were traveling to this and if people knew that we were not supposed to tour prospective projects.
Mr. Chair,
please.
Councilman Bronson, this paragraph is here exactly for that reason. It's up to the council to determine whether or not they want to continue this policy. The opinion of Chair Kilgore and the council at the time was that travel to prospective projects, because you couldn't travel to all of them, would give a leg up to some of them. That's up to you to decide whether you still believe that's the case.
Sure, Les.
Mr. Chair, I had questions on that paragraph also, and I guess to summarize it bluntly, present ignorance or future knowledge. And I think the council is in a position to let their professional judgment report back to the other members on reviewing projects and try to bring the other council members up to an equal level of knowledge on those projects, and to say future projects, well, many of these projects are contiguous. There will be one proposal this year, but there may be an addition to it in the next couple of years. So you can't really, I pretty much totally disagree with that statement about not visiting the projects. I think we can gain a lot. We can report back to the council. Yes, there's going to be opinions expressed, but those opinions are formulated by the experience that we have. That's why we're here. So I would say it's highly advisable to look at as many projects as we possibly can, and we can't do it as a full council. We're going to have to split it up by individual law. Especially, I like the idea of doing it by geographic area, splitting it up, and let us understand what the restrictions are as far as advance approval, and go out and see some of these projects. The shallow lakes would be a good example in the Prairie Potholes region. There's probably 35 projects in there. We should be getting out and looking at those and see are some of them good, some of them bad, working with the NGOs or the agencies to formulate a better understanding of these.
Mr. Chair, I just want to point out, too, that perhaps, we should might put some parameters around prospective projects. In the case that Ryan mentioned, that was a project that had been recommended by this body, and so I think we need to differentiate between before the council makes a recommendation on a program or a project to visit and prior to that recommendation process.
Kenny?
Well, I would kind of agree with Les. There's two issues here. When I first read this, I thought, that was when they were so worried about spending money they didn't want to. But that's not really what this paragraph. If this paragraph is an accurate reflection of the early Lessard-Sams Council, I think it's a mistake. I think they should actually encourage people to feel free, anybody, to go visit any of the projects. My own personal feeling is if you show up and look at a project and nobody knows you're coming, that's the best way to look at it, because they don't tend to get all ready and make it look different than maybe it'll look like when you just go look at it on your own. A separate discussion would be, how do you deal with, now all of a sudden is this a free opportunity for them to collect mileage and per diem to go wherever they want? And some of us got more time on our hands than others, and we may look at it that way, but I mean, I would not agree with this paragraph that it should say we should be discouraged, because my own personal experience is it's very valuable to see them on site, but you do need to be careful about them glossing it over and making it look good for you because they know you're coming or only take you to the parts where they want you to go. A separate discussion would be, if we're going to change that policy, is how do we deal now with the economic cost and all that? Because I do have apprehensions of just opening it up and going to reimburse somebody 50 cents a mile to drive to Thief River Falls because they got nothing better to do. I mean, not that that really would happen, but...
Well, and there's nothing that has prohibited anybody from going and visiting anything. It's the reimbursement part. You know, the policy is what gets reimbursed and per diem and such. It's not that you're not allowed to go visit a project. It's, is the council going to pay for you to go visit whatever projects? This is really the point of the policy.
So, Mr. Chair, that's what I originally thought this paragraph said, that dealt with reimbursement. So it does, but you read that paragraph as its own. It tells you don't go look at the projects because we want you to judge them without seeing them. Was this more in the context of reimbursement is how it was written?
Well,
because that's what I originally thought it was.
I think it wasn't 100% clear when we talked about it, but this was about establishing procedures for how we were going to operate and basically trying to avoid having the council visit some projects and then not others and come under criticism for favoritism, as well as on a smaller level, how do we control the cost? But it was clearly, how do we not show favoritism? How do we manage this so that it doesn't appear that if you can get yourself to a project, get yourself on a list of a field trip, you're far better off in terms of getting your project approved. That was the rationale. Jim?
Yeah, and just to add to that, David, I think, you know, we didn't want to, why would somebody want to go look at a project? Because they have some prejudice to it. Either they're in favor of it or they're against it. So to sponsor a council member or somebody to go to see a project that they have a personal interest in and then come back and give some kind of description saying, I've been there, it gave some kind of prejudice to the process. And I think that's what we were trying to get away from.
Wayne?
I do remember, surprisingly, way back then, the conversation, and the way it's written isn't exactly the whole, that's probably the truth, but it's not really accurate. What the discussion we had was all about was back then, we were trying to figure out how many dollars we had to spend for travel, and we were concerned about how the citizens would look at us traveling all over Minnesota looking at projects. And we felt that there had to be some way to do that. Then the discussion came up about that it would lend some priority in voting to a project if people had gone and looked at it. And I remember making the comment, don't we all have some prejudices before we can go look at the project? I'll bet you I voted on some projects here already because I already know them. I've already seen them.
You can put beer cans on
there. Yeah, Grand Belt Hill. I mean, I knew that one. Danny, you've got one that's kind of in your backyard. You're very well informed about that one. And so, I mean, it's like we all have some prejudices. And so I think that this became a statement to kind of cover our bases. But I really do believe that the whole discussion when we started was all about finances, that we didn't want to have the public looking at us as a bunch of people running all over the state of Minnesota, spending $100,000 in travel, and then for what? And that's what the original discussion was.
Thank you for your memory. Tom, did you have?
Oh.
Pam?
Is there something magic about 30 days in advance? If we were to go that way, you know, 30 days in advance of the proposed date?
It gives us plenty of time to get the information to, but we can change.
You know, I've looked at a couple things over the 1 year that I've been working on the council, and there were a couple things that came up that I thought would improve my ability to represent the citizens by getting feet on the ground. And I basically worked through the staff, and I didn't find that burdensome at all. And I think there should be accountability that goes with it. There should be advance notice, and there should be some reporting. I mean, if you're doing your job and getting reimbursement for it, then I think you do need to report. But in particular, you know, the high-dollar projects, I think it's really important to get out there and see them. If you are, have a personal interest in it, you need to recuse yourself from the get-go. So I don't see how that could be a negative. And, you know, when you're talking millions of dollars, all of these are millions of dollars, but, you know, in this last session, the Upper Mississippi Project, I think all of us should have been there, and it only enhanced your ability to make good decisions, for plus or minus. So, I mean, having this kind of requirement in writing, I think, is a good thing. I don't know if 30 days would be it would have removed the ability for me to do some of the things that came across, but I suppose you could ask whatever the destination is, and if they could push it off later, too. But I don't like the idea of not going to see a prospective project.
Mr.
Chair, I think
Chair,
that's the most important time to go.
We can change the 30 days if that's what's desired. I wanted the council to understand what rules we're operating under as staff and how we're interpreting them so that we can get some new interpretations. And I would say that I believe the Northwoods visit that you took was authorized as a blanket visit. Any council member could go and get reimbursed. So there is that facility.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't believe it was covered by the 30 days,
to be quite frank.
Okay.
What I would say is I'd like to, and maybe at some point, see if staff could come back maybe at our next meeting, but I would want to encourage everybody to visit any project they want to visit ahead of time. A separate issue, I would say, is if you feel you need to be compensated per diem or mileage to go to that, then you have to go through a process to go through. I didn't ask anybody if I could go look at any of the projects I wanted to go look at because I just went and looked at them. I didn't put in for any reimbursement or expect to get any. But in some situations you may want to, then I think we should have some process in place for that. But I would say anybody wondering, I mean, most likely why I would want to go is because maybe I don't understand or don't know what the project's about, or as Jane said, if the economic significance is bigger, we're probably more likely. And I think I wouldn't be going there with the idea of wanting to necessarily be the voice for the entire board on the project. I think that could be problematic. I mean, if we start sending somebody, some of us maybe already let our position somewhat known on it. Well, now you're going to send me to go look at Northwoods? I mean, I don't imagine that most of people would think that's a good idea. You know, and I'm supposed to report back on what I find. Well, I could have wrote that in a certain way, but to encourage any or everybody to go look. So I'd like it to not say what this says and encourage people to know they're free. We're supposed to make recommendations for how the state should spend $100 million, and this says that we are not supposed to find out what it's about.
And we can't talk about it either.
Well, yeah.
But it does say the council would not accept invitations. It doesn't say individuals wouldn't go.
Well, excuse me, Mr. Chair, correct me if I'm wrong. We can't stop a member from going
that's
and looking
exactly,
at a project.
That's my point.
I mean, I would say that's our job, that if we want to think we're doing a good job and we're wondering about a project and not knowing,
take
a look at it.
Yeah, I'm agreeing with you. Jim?
What happens then if potential proposers then say, Jim, I want to take you up and I want to take Les up to see our potential project? We'll take you up there and we'll show it to you.
At this point, My understanding is you're welcome to go. They can't pay your way. You can pay your way, but they can't pay your way. Because that would, you're a public official.
And then they're both getting information.
But if they're two, it doesn't violate the open meeting law.
Or you can do it like I did. As I was driving from Aiken to Brainerd, when I passed the landfill, then I knew I was in the right spot. Stop. Now, I was counting on the fact that I wouldn't get ticketed for trespassing. And I went and looked at the property. Came back, drove by the airport. I don't know if you guys know that it's between an airport and a landfill.
Oh, I think we do.
And then went home. But what bothered me was that then somebody told the Star Tribune that I had never toured the place. Well, or they made that up on their own. So that was annoying. And then I read the policy that says I shouldn't have gone and looked at it because we shouldn't be looking at prospective proposals.
But Ryan, that was not a prospective proposal. We'd already voted and allocated money.
Right.
So it was after the fact. If you
so for those of the, for the members that voted yes in the way that the Star Tribune wanted them to vote, they did it without looking at the proposal. And I voted no without looking at the proposal, so what was the problem? My
well,
beef was with the Star Tribune, obviously.
It is. And we're not going to solve that today.
Well, just a couple of things. Hopefully that if we violate the 30-day rule, it isn't an automatic rejection. Do our best to do that. One other point is international travel, which one I'm referring to, the Red River Basin Conference. Now, this year it will be in Grand Forks, North Dakota, but I can see Minnesota. In Fargo, I can see Minnesota. In Winnipeg, we couldn't quite see that. So hopefully there's a little common sense that applies to that. And we'll be submitting a request for this year on it.
So if I can summarize, it sounds like we would like staff to come back with a recommended modification that would not prohibit the council members from going and looking at prospective projects, and probably reduce the time frame from the 30 days to try to make it easier. And I don't think that's been a barrier anywhere that I know of, but just so that it doesn't become a barrier anyway. Anything else in all of this that people would like to bring up?
David, but still, I think the point that Mike was trying to make here is that the council itself is not going to accept invitations as a whole like we're doing today to visit prospective projects. And I think the reason he wanted to do that is just because we can't see them all in 1 year, and he felt it gave an unfair advantage. Does the council still think that's a good position?
I do remember the field trip we took to southeast Minnesota, and we were supposed to be getting a tour of the area,
right,
and the issues, and all of a sudden we had somebody beating us over the head to support their specific project,
right,
not to educate us about the issues in the
right
region. And it was, it was uncomfortable at that point. Both uncomfortable because it was against what we'd specifically told that person to do, and uncomfortable because we were all on the spot.
I mean, I think it's fine for individual members or groups to go look at prospective projects, but to have the whole council go look at a prospective project and not be able to see all of them, I think, without question, that gives those projects an upper leg in getting funded.
Wayne, did you have?
Yeah, just because now every time that they have a project up here in the Duluth area, plans will fly up, and remake a request to where we can have to put a budget limit on this thing if we open the door up to kind of like, hey, I don't want to because I don't know what our budget is for that right now.
On a personal level, I'd like to not try to worry about the cat or worry about the horse getting out of the barn and see if we can use reasonable discretion instead of creating rules that are hard and fast that people are going to chafe against. I think, you know, if one of us starts to travel all over, we're going to have an individual conversation about it being unreasonable. And I would say I think I disagree with Les on let's take regions and we're all responsible for specific regions, because it sets us up for then we've got to get members selected to represent specific regions, and we need to represent the state. All of us need to represent the state, not the region. Well, I think it's very clear that, Les, you're going to have more expertise in your neighborhood, and you're going to more likely travel to see a project there than you are in Albert Lea. And that's okay, but to start to mandate specifics, I would worry about us doing that.
The reason for my question was for Bill and staff, is that I remember it wasn't too long ago where a request was made to attend, I think it was a round table a couple of years ago, and they said, well, we're going to limit to two because we don't have the money to do this, and so if somebody then couldn't go, if you weren't one of the first four that requested. So I don't want to put Bill and staff in the situation where all of a sudden we start getting some requests and say we don't know whether we should be allowing this money or not.
Mr. Chair, we budget for 15 full council meetings and hold eight or nine, and the individual member travel comes out of the savings that is achieved there, and we can track it closely.
I think when we put a new budget together, it's part of the consideration of the budget. And, you know, if we need to allocate an extra $5,000 to travel because there's more interest in travel than we've been funding in the past, I can't imagine that as a group we're going to have a problem doing just that. As long as it doesn't include the private airplane for you to fly to Duluth.
Helicopter?
You're not getting that either.
Motorcycle?
Maybe. But you won't get 50 cents a mile.
Way to go.
Mr. Chair, are our travel expenses published on our website? Is that something that we disclose on our website?
It's not disclosed on the website. It has been the subject of FOIs, Freedom of Information requests. We're popular.
Well, it's public information.
It's public information, that's
yeah.
Right.
Where would the public find it?
They call him up and say, send me Ryan's travel, and he has to do it.
That's a big number. It's a big number.
but that's the process.
Okay.
It's all public.
But the current policy is that you and another member of the executive committee are involved in any okaying any travel of any one of us now. And I think it's been working, as I think we've heard. So I would agree with you that my guess is if I was the one always asking to get reimbursed for mileage, you might say, you know, Denny, you've been traveling a lot more than the other
members.
Pretty soon
it becomes,
you want to go on your own.
Yeah, it becomes my unfortunate responsibility to have a conversation.
As Jane said, it's tough being at the top, Mr. Chair. So.
You can handle it.
Less. Just a quick comment. Some other functions that kind of fall in between. We've got the NGOs in the state, great distribution and populace of those. Pheasants Forever, Ducks Unlimited, the state conventions, deer hunters. I think these need to be attended for our presence and distribution of information. I think they're very valuable. We both were at the DU. Mention. I know the Pheasants Forever, and especially the DNR Roundtable. Excellent get together of exchanging ideas and exchanging information. So those are important ones.
Other comments? Are you comfortable having staff come back with slight modifications to this at our next meeting that clarify our position that it's okay to visit projects. The council won't accept invitations, but individuals might. And it's okay to ask for reimbursement for those specific requests. Is that the read of the group?
Mr. Chair, I just would be happy to do it, and just to let you know, at the top of page 3 are our suggested changes. When it's appropriate to travel, and with the addition of to visit. Projects yep. will.
This is the clarification that you're recommending, and we're asking you to add it in a fourth bullet point.
Right.
And so at the next meeting, what you'll see is 4 bullet points that we'll add to our travel policy. Okay? Jane?
Are we striking prospective?
No.
I want to strike prospective.
You're alone.
No.
I disagree that visiting a site would only result in a positive evaluation.
No, we're not talking about individuals. We're talking about the council as a whole, like today.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, okay. You can go anytime you want.
Okay.
Yeah. Individuals could visit prospective
okay.
projects.
Okay.
But the council won't go on a field trip to a prospective project.
All right.
And, you know, I will say if there was a specific project that the council said as a group we want to go, we can do that. But what we don't want to do is put staff in the position of having projects say, you know, can you arrange for the council to come see mine but not go see
right.
those other ones? So it's really about, as we organize field trips like we're going to go on today and tomorrow, that we're going for information, not to review projects that are in the mill.
Okay.
But if I understood you right, Mr. Chair, there could be an example where you have a conversation and you're thinking and you talk to a couple members or something and say, you know, this is a really big, important one that's not well understood. I think in conversation probably with Bill and maybe some other executive council members, you say, I think we should host a public meeting, get a bus, and we're all going to go look at this project because it's $25 million and it's, you know, 25% of our budget, but
it's that important.
You would have that ability.
I don't think that this would prohibit us from doing that. It's accepting invitations, not us deciding on making a visit. Okay?
I'm not alone.
You're together.
Thank goodness.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. We're going to get next. Our last thing is to approve the accomplishment plans on the consent agenda. Before we did that, we wanted to let the public have an opportunity to address the council with regard to specifically anything on the consent list. The reason we have the public comment before consent list is so that if there are comments, we could pull one from the consent list or anything else. But that's just why we set the agenda up this way. Does anyone want to address the council?
Bill, can I be on? Bill, Dave Holmbeck here.
This is the gentleman with the issues regarding Deer Lake.
Okay. You're certainly welcome to address the council. I would ask you to address the council on issues that pertain to council business, not other issues. Because we can't do anything, from the information I saw, we can't do anything about your issues. So bring it to relevance to us as a council.
And might I add, they have
received...
You
read my narrative. Are you saying it's not germane to your group? Is that what you're
As it was presented to me in the council,
okay.
You know, I'm okay with you doing it. I just
okay.
want you to know we're here on council business, not on
Got
other
it.
Business.
Got it.
Well, that's what they just
got it.
So if you feel you want to...
else from the audience, but I can wait otherwise...
Nobody else rose their hand,
okay.
So this is your
Thank
chance.
You. Thank you.
Might I...
Oh.
I just have a question. Is there? I came late. And I apologize, but is there an ongoing court case related to this?
Yes, there is.
As a legislator, I just kind of have a uncomfortableness about talking about things that are in court. You know, and I mean, if you want to hear them, go ahead. But I just I'm not even sure we should hear it personally, but that's just my opinion.
My question was, is it our business? But I don't know what you want to say, so I can't prejudge that. But
Representative Lilly, what I have to say today, although I reference a court case, it is not part of the case. The two cases before the Minnesota Supreme Court are the loss of the tax exempt status by the Bible camp. I'm just saying what I have today is result of that. What happens there, that's germane to that court case. There is a Court of Appeals case coming up in July, in so much that Itasca County ordered an EIS of the Bible camp. The Bible camp brought that to the district court. The district court judge deposed one of the county commissioners. In other words, removed her vote from that EIS vote. So instead of 3-1, it was 2-1. So what that did then is force another EAW. However, the Lake Association, Deer Lake Association, and Itasca County appealed that to the Court of Appeals. What I have to present to you today is get our staff and university staff their complicity in causing that EIS vote.
Make it something relevant to what we do as a council, which is recommend to the legislature money for projects, habitat projects.
Mr. Holmbeck?
Yes.
May I explain what the members have in their packets?
Go ahead.
Mr. Holmbeck sent us his remarks, and they're titled LSOHC June 6, 2012. It's about 10 pages. 6 pages are remarks. You also have a item titled Meeting Summary, which was provided by the Legislative Auditor's Office, who was concerned about the description of their responsiveness and provided this as evidence of what they had done. So, you're welcome to go ahead.
That office did not send me a copy.
We'll get you one.
All right, thank you very much.
Doesn't say anything bad.
That's fine.
Go ahead.
Thank you, council members, Mr. Chair. What you have in front of you will take longer than 5 minutes. However, I'm not going to read it line for line. But I'm going to follow the general outline of that. And afterwards, if you want to talk to me, ask me questions, I have my phone number there, give me a call. I'll be glad to clarify any questions you have. I'm a retired DNR employee. During this time, I oversaw scores of EAWs and EISs. Throughout my career, I have seen project opponents attempt to force an EIS as a ploy to kill or delay a project indefinitely. My presentation today is about a flawed EIS vote by Itasca County for a Bible camp.
So let me just please make it relevant to us.
All right. Okay. I guess I cannot read from there, but I will make it relative to my visit with Mr. Nobles. I met with him in January for 2 hours. 1 hour was relative to the Bible camp, and evidently that's, in your opinion, that's not relative to you. However, for 1 hour, I did talk to him about the Dark River project. And I did say that the DNR did not obtain the necessary easements to do work on the Dark River. Now, you're going to be given a tour by Mike and Mr. Lindgren and Mr. Peterson, and I think these are going to be good projects. And I'm sure they're going to tell you that they obtained the necessary easements before the work was done. And the easements are critical for a couple reasons. Number one, they protect the landowner. He may be getting some money or some benefit by that easement. But they also protect the investment of the taxpayers and or the fishermen. Because the landowner, once he signs that easement, he has to allow fishing or access, or he can't go in with his backhoe and tear up a structure. So when I met with Mr. Nobles, I said the Dark River Project that was done in 2005. The DNR went on private property without the necessary easement. They spent taxpayer money on that project. Furthermore, their permits required, their public waters, working the bed of public waters requires, Mike, what are you leaving for? Requires an easement, a written permit by the landowner. That was not obtained. So once again, my discussion with Mr. Nobles addressed two topics, the Bible camp, which I will not get into today, but it did talk about the Minnesota DNR spending state monies on a project that where there was no easement, and that's a violation of statute. Evidently, he's found none from what his email to me. Now, this is Dennis Good. Dennis is the president of the Dark River Basin Association. He can affirm what I just said to you. Thank you. That's all I have.
Okay. Yes. Danny?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Holmbeck, you and I have met a couple times, and I appreciate that. And I will just say I think the right venue for you to pursue is with the legislature. If you're disappointed in some of the activities of some of the agencies that we in the legislature have to deal with, that's the correct place for you to go to there. I think the chair has laid out, this is a public comment period for stuff that deals with Lasard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council work, and your issues are unrelated to here, whether they're valid or not valid. The other thing is, I'm a believer, like Representative Lilly, if this is our court cases ongoing, we are going to be very careful in the legislature. We are not the court. We need to let the courts take their place.
Yes.
And I am not comfortable weighing in or getting involved in the middle of a court case. And so I just want to say I appreciate coming down here. I believe you're up in the Grand Rapids area, but I think it's inappropriate for this board to deal with this issue.
Representative McNamara, can I have you as my contact on this matter then?
Well, I like Representative Lilly, if you're in the middle of a court case, I'm not going to discuss a court case ongoing because I want to respect people's right to pursue and what they feel is their legal deals. But if you want to contact me, you can.
My office is open.
You're free to contact me outside of this group.
And just as a clarification, this council has said when it funds projects on private land, it has to be on land covered by a permanent conservation easement, so we are not getting into the situation that you described, which is a landowner going in and removing the improvements paid for with public dollars. That was one of our very first premises as we set our rules for what we would fund. It had to have permanent easements, and anybody who has information that we've funded something and the easement has been said to be there and it wasn't there, we do want to know about. But I don't think this project we funded, so it's tough for us to get too involved. But we certainly would be very interested in knowing if we've funded projects and a representation that an easement has been there that isn't there exists. Any other public comments? So we have in front of us the consent agenda for accomplishment plans. That is agenda item number 8. There are on that more than I can count accomplishment plans, which were in your book, you've had a chance to review. There were 5 accomplishment plans which were pulled from the consent agenda. And there was a feeling with all of those from staff that they had changed from what we had originally heard in one way or another, and that we wanted at our August meeting for those proposers to come back to us and explain what the changes were. And each one is a little bit different. We need to get into the detail of that before we approve it as a group. So With that, I would love to start with a motion to approve the consent agenda, which is page 1 and 2, accomplishment plans, on agenda item 8.
Hello, Mr. Chair.
I would like to remove one of the projects in the consent agenda.
Which one?
That would be 5I, the Outdoor Heritage Conservation Legacy Grant Program.
Okay. Would Ryan, are you willing to modify your motion to exclude 5I, and we will put that on the agenda to come back. Jim, will you communicate with staff about specifically what you want them to address when they come in?
Okay.
Any others like that? So we'll have 6 projects in August 1st at our meeting to review the modified or the accomplishment plans if we approve this motion. Is there any other discussion, comments? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you all. I believe that concludes our business today. We do have a tour. Sandy, do you have the details of the tour here? How we're getting to the tour and
follow
Mr. Chair, members, just real briefly, we scheduled to depart at 3 o'clock, but we have 3 of them to be able to load up. Some of you will want to grab jackets or deposit stuff, that's fine, in cars or wherever. If